UK Wine Show, show number 98. Wine writer, Susie Atkins. On this week's show...
And I live near Exeter, and one thing over the last year that has been thrilling is Southwest English wines.
In the news this week, France creates new national wine label... Wild yeast discovery gives fruit a boost, and pregnant women told to avoid alcohol.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 98 for the 28th of March 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with wine writer Susie Atkins. Susie is a wine writer for Delicious Magazine and the Sunday Telegraph, and we find out about how she got to where she is and what the future holds for Susie. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. A new French national wine label, Vin de Pays Vignoble de France, is finding its way onto our shelves. This new category is a French multi-regional blend, allowing wines to be blended from any of the 64 geographical areas in France. Although French viticulture has always been based on wines of specific terroirs, with globalisation and the increasing importance of brands, France has struggled to meet the needs of the international market and compete with the new world. The new denomination should make French wine more competitive, but there are still rules, of course. Wines have to qualify for Vin de Pays using approved grape varieties, and blends can only be made of up to three varieties. But as well as sourcing from different regions, the grapes for these new national wines can also be from different vintages. Next up, researchers in New Zealand have discovered a wild yeast that increases the fruity qualities of Sauvignon Blanc. The yeast lifts the gooseberry, passion fruit and grapefruit flavours that are so important to the New Zealand Sauvignons, as well as increasing mouthfeel and complexity. The find came about as part of a six-year New Zealand government-funded research programme, which is seeking to understand what makes Kiwi Sauvignon Blanc the way it is. Commercial trials using the yeast are underway at several Marlborough vineyards, and if successful, these more zingy, fruity wines may be on shelves in 2 to 3 years' time. And finally this week, women in the UK are now being told they shouldn't drink any alcohol during pregnancy, despite no new evidence that a small amount is harmful. The National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, NICE, has issued new guidelines saying that pregnant women should avoid drinking alcohol, especially during the first 3 months, because there may be an increased risk of miscarriage. If women choose to drink, they're advised to drink no more than 1 to 2 UK units once or twice a week. This brings NICE guidelines in line with Department of Health advice, but is confusing for women who were told last year that it was okay to drink a small glass of wine a day while pregnant. Dr. Gillian Leng, Deputy Chief Executive of NICE, said the aim of the change was to make things simpler, but she admitted that clinical evidence was fairly weak. For more details on these stories, please visit the news homepage of our website 3050.co.uk. Back to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. Nice to see NICE flip-flopping over the advice on alcohol given to pregnant women. With quotes such as, clinical evidence is fairly weak, NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, is no longer paying attention to clinical excellence at all. The change in policy is not because they suddenly feel a glass of wine a day or even 1 or 2 a week is too much. It's because they're trying to stop people from drinking more than that, where there's some fairly clear evidence of harm to baby from high alcohol levels. It's a bit like the units of alcohol guidelines, which are nothing to do with your physical health limits. They're about social conditioning of society. To me, the guidelines should be clear and meaningful. Don't drink to this point because of physical harm to yourself or your child. Not don't drink to this level because you may have no self-control and go over it and reach a level where we don't want you drinking to. Which, by the way, they don't want to tell you what that limit is, just in case they confuse you. Because you've got no self-control and you're too stupid to understand the message. Let's have clinical decisions based on clinical evidence, not social engineering. Any dramatic change in policy based on no new evidence and, at best, fairly weak evidence is sad and pathetic. They should be commissioning research in something if they feel it's so important, rather than just banning something straight out. Obviously, you can tell I'm a bit excited by all this. Let me pull myself back from the brink there. I have a scientific mind, and I hate social engineering dressed up as science. It's wrong. But let's just calm down a bit and have a look at some other stories. I thought that it was fairly interesting about the Vignoble de France, a Van de Pay wine from across France. While I support the idea of blending wines from different regions, after all, the Aussies are now blending Aussie and Chilean wines together in some of their big bulk brands, let alone southeastern Australia, which is pretty much all of the wine-producing region of Australia except for Margaret River on the west coast. But I do get a wee bit confused by this one. The idea of Van de Pay was to create a wine from a particular region that had a reflection of that region. So I would have thought a wine of France would have gone possibly under the Van de Tarbe heading, which was designated for this type of blending. But I think there could be some exciting wines coming out if you can blend maybe the acidity from the north with the ripe flavours from the south. I haven't seen any yet, but they're due to arrive in the UK in the next month or so keep an eye out for them. Something else that's a wee bit overdue is this month's poll. I was going to close it off and give you the results this month, but I got my dates wrong. It'll be next month, after the end of March. As you recall, the question was, fair trade wine is made in Chile, Argentina, and South Africa. If it was available alongside other wines, would you buy it? Do go to our website, ukwineshow.co.uk, and have your say. While you're at your computer, I'd love to have some feedback from you, particularly about our spotlight section. You can email me any feedback at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. I'd really like to know what you think of the spotlight, whether it's a bit too in-depth, not too in-depth enough, too short, too long, anything like that would be fantastic to know. This week we finish up looking at oak barrels, and next week we're going to be looking at our first book review, Hugh Johnson and Jensen Robinson's The World Atlas of Wine. But for now, let's have the final installment on oak barrels. And this week we're talking about oak barrel alternatives. In recent years, the use of oak staves, chips, and powder have been seen in many cheap wines and some mid-priced wines. The idea is the surface area of the wine that is in contact with the oak will increase the flavor extraction of the wood. And staves, chips, or powder submerged in the wine increases the surface area considerably. But oak barrels do two things. They impart flavor and allow for a small amount of oxygen to seep through the wood into the wine. This oxygenation helping with many of the chemical processes going on inside the barrel. Many winemakers are aware of the benefits of this micro-oxidization and have been bubbling oxygen through their stainless steel tanks for a while to mimic it. With increased surface area associated with chips and micro-oxidization, it's becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference between barrels and chips. The cutting edge with staves, chips, and powders has been on the importance of seasoning those staves, chips, and powders. Improvements have been steady, and some winemakers can no longer tell the difference between chips and barrels. A well-made wine using a chip will be better than a poor wine made in a barrel. Winemakers are increasingly planning to use chips and staves in mid-priced wines, with several premium wines now using the technology. The use of various oak alternatives at different stages of fermentation and aging, with or without micro-oxidization, gives winemakers an enormous range of possibilities for experimentation. There are lots of opportunities to increase the quality and decrease the price that a barrel simply cannot offer. For example, it is not usually possible to ferment reds in barrels. Currently, the earliest winemakers can transfer red wine into a barrel is during the final stages of alcoholic fermentation. But oak alternatives can be used during fermentation when it is claimed that they help build the structure, fix colour, and reduce green notes. The benefits of alternatives to oak barrels are price. Chips and staves cost a fraction of a barrel. A typical 225-litre barrel costs around £400, adding around £1.30 to the cost of a bottle of wine. Barrels take up space and require expensive racking solutions. Time. Barrels require filling, emptying, and topping up, all taking time and have a labour cost. The quality of alternatives have increased considerably over the last 4 years or so, and it allows winemakers to experiment with different styles. While barrels are the earliest piece of winemaking technology, they are a tried and tested way of bringing up fine wines. It seems that for the adventurous winemaker, A combination of barrel alternatives with micro-oxidization promise a range of powerful and cost-effective tools to increase the quality of the wine. As the quality of the products on offer increases and more data is accumulated on their use, it is likely that oak alternatives won't always be seen as rather devious shortcut to dressing up cheap wines, but increasingly used for premium wines. That ends the spotlight. I hope you've been enjoying the spotlight on oak barrels. Next week we'll have a book review, The World Wine Atlas by Hugh Johnson and Jensis Robinson. Jensis is probably the UK's most serious wine journalist, but another wine writer is Susie Atkins. She's a wine writer for Delicious Magazine and editor of the book Wine Made Easy. Susie's next to tell us about being a wine writer and what's in store in the future for Susie. Let's have a listen to what Susie has to say. Hi, I'm here with Susie Atkins, wine writer for Delicious Magazine and the Sunday Telegraph. We're going to be talking a bit about yourself today. Okay. How did you get into wine? You know, you've obviously got a great job.
Oh, I feel like I've got the best job in the world. I mean, who wouldn't want to work with the lovely liquid that is wine? I got into it about 17, 18 years ago when I joined Wine Magazine, now called Wine and Spirit, yeah, as kind of a young reporter, really. And I knew very little about wine at that point, but I was extremely keen on wine and food, fast becoming a foodie, and rushed off and did the higher certificate, now the advanced certificate, the good old trade qualifications.
WACT.
WACT, learned very quickly, really had to go for it. And obviously, you know, when you're hired to be a wine reporter, you get to go to so many tastings and so many wine regions. It is just the best way to learn. So I was very, very lucky. So all through my 20s, I just gathered up all this knowledge.
Excellent. How's your liver holding out then?
Oh, I'm still here. For now. But if this is going out in 3 or 4 months, I'm not sure.
We'll see how it goes. Okay. So you started out writing. You fell into a dream job, really, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I didn't fall into it. I was working for a business magazine for the same stable. And although I loved working for a magazine, I didn't really want the subject to be business. And I really set my sights on this wine magazine. I knew that's what I wanted to do. And sure enough, it was a dream job. And I haven't really looked back. I went freelance in 1994 because I wanted to spend some time in Australia, and I went there for 6 weeks.
Yep.
And I worked at St. Hallett's Winery and Charles Melton's Wineries, living between the two on the Krondorf Road near Tanunda in Adelaide, yep, near Adelaide, and filed back reports to Wine Magazine in the UK about how the harvest was going. And I must say, I was the worst cellar hand you've ever seen in your life. Let's just say I didn't give up the day job, and the writing continued. But yeah, that was great fun reporting from Australia. But after that, I jumped ship and became a freelance, still writing for wine, but very much working from home and starting to write for other magazines and doing a bit of broadcasting. Yep.
And did you go, which came first, Sunday Telegraph or Delicious?
Oh, Delicious. I've worked for Delicious UK ever since it launched here 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I did a lot of work for Which? The Consumers Association. Which magazine? I compiled their wine reports, still do from time to time.
Yep.
And I co-edited the Which Wine Guide for several editions, mm-hmm, in the late 90s and through to about 2004, I think.
Yeah.
So, and then Delicious Magazine, which was great to be involved with them from their start-up here in the UK. And then the Sunday Telegraph, I've just got a column about 18 months ago. So that's
all quite new.
That's new and exciting. And it was a brand new column, which is great because it's a small world and you don't really want to be treading on anyone's toes. But the Stella magazine, part of the Sunday Telegraph, is mainly aimed at women.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted, I guess they'd read my book, The Girl's Guide to Wine, which is a kind of humorous debunking pocket guide. And
I think my wife's read that, actually. I haven't read it. But
you're not allowed to read it. It's The Girl's Guide to Wine. It is. It's very tongue-in-cheek, but they hired me to write. I guess the column is, I hope, informative and helpful, but it is, you know, written a little bit tongue-in-cheek and I hope in a kind of lively, down-to-earth way. So that's been the new project for the last 18 months.
But I noticed in Delicious recently you did a beer comparison as opposed to wine. How did that go?
Well, I mean, you know, the editor occasionally, Matthew Drennan, who's instigated all sorts of exciting new projects there since he took over, he says, let's do different drinks sometimes, Susie. Let's do beer, let's do cocktails, all sorts of newsy tips. And that's been a steep learning curve for me because I must admit, unlike some drinks writers, I had stuck very much to wine. I don't really write about spirits or beers or cocktails. So I've had to in the last year. I've gone out and I've learned and I've Well, just as we all do, spoken to the experts, really, and yep. tried to mug up on these subjects. Fascinating, what other worlds of drinks.
Yeah, we do the odd beer tasting in our business, but I don't know. I'm a lager drinker. I think it's about as sophisticated as I get with
Well, most of us wine buffs, we like those kind of Aussie Cooper's Creek style, not Cooper's Creek, Cooper's sparkling ales, or those kind of lighter beers, don't we?
Yeah, because when you finish tasting a load of wines, all I want is something simple
and
refreshing.
You want a palate freshener.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
want to wake me up. So yeah, I've had to get into the kind of the chocolatey flavours and the big stouts and stuff, and it's just a whole other world.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah. I think the only beer of any sort of class, I think any camera people out there will laugh at me, but I quite like Badger Golden Glory Ale because it's got a lovely peachy nose. It reminds me of a wine almost.
So it's fruity. Absolutely. Fruity. I think the fruitier wines appeal to us wine buffs. But one thing for me was going, I went to the Wychwood Brewery near Oxford so long ago. Absolutely. Lovely independent sort of small to medium sized brewery. Very near where my parents live and where I grew up. So I had a very happy day there over the summer, the last summer. And I tasted through a wide range of their beers and was really tutored in that by the people there. And we did a lot of food matching. We matched the beers with food. And to taste these proper English ales with all these different, you know, Ploughman's, or one went with a fruitcake, one went with cheeses, one went with hams. It was a bit of a revelation. It was a good moment where I realised beer could be complex and fascinating too.
Yeah, so excellent.
I'll come to one of your talks on beer, I hope.
No, it's not me. I don't do beer tastings.
Okay, your colleague.
I get my Charles to do that. Mm. Okay, back to wine.
Sure.
Have you been doing much tasting or travelling around recently?
Yeah, I guess I've done a bit less travelling in the last 3 years or so because I've got my second child now, who's 3 and a half.
Oh, excellent.
So before that, I travelled, I reckoned, about a third of my time I was on the road abroad. But I've gone back to it a bit more recently again, having been a bit quiet and just been at home writing for a bit. I'm now back. I went to Bordeaux last November. I went to Chile in March.
Yeah.
Did a good week in Chile, which was great. I hadn't been for 10 years just to see the progress that
country's
made.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit, hasn't it?
It had changed so much. 10 years was disgraceful. I should have gone in between. But it's gone from being 10 years ago, or be 11 years really now, a country that churned out a lot of perfectly decent, good value red and white, to suddenly I was seeing all these premium stars coming out, the higher altitude vineyard wines, the kind of super cuvées, if you like. And it was just suddenly the focus was on quality this time around.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting. Yeah.
And some of the new regions, particularly further south, maybe a bit cooler?
Yes. And Lader in particular, I thought was fascinating. The Lader region, Leyda, which is near the coast, a cooler climate region where they're still planting away, but making really fine Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs. And
have you seen any Sevies that rival New Zealand? Because a lot of people talk about them. Whenever I go to shows, though, I can't quite get them to the same
They're
quality.
Not the same. Nothing is like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. I've
Good
yet to taste.
I've been looking for them as well.
I've yet to taste Sauvignon Blanc that is very similar to Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, although I am impressed by the best South African ones, which I think taste quite grassy and green peppery, a bit more towards that green kind of stalky character. The Chileans have a lovely pure fruit character in theirs, but it's not that gooseberry that you get from New Zealand. So the best ones are good. They're as good, if you like, but they're different.
They are
different.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. That's what I like to hear.
I really do, at home, drink more New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc than any other style of wine.
Even better.
I'm trying to push those figures up single-handedly.
What sort of wines have maybe excited you in the last year?
Well, as I say, those premium Chilean styles that I had perhaps had managed to miss up till now, they were very exciting indeed. I've tasted a lot of fizz this year, and I'm newly impressed by perhaps some better value champagnes than in the past. I was a real one for moaning on about cheaper champagnes being tart and nasty. I've perhaps come round to those a bit more recently.
Is that because your palate's changed, or do you think the quality's changed?
No, the quality's changed. No, I'd like to think my palate has. My palate didn't even change in pregnancy. You know, it does remain pretty consistent. So far in my life. But no, I think quality's gone up. It's a bit like we've seen in Bordeaux. We've seen the cheaper Bordeaux that used to be so embarrassingly poor, to be honest, pick up a lot and start to look good. Spain remains very interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. Goodness, where, what excites me? Everything excites me. There's very little that I think is horrible, apart from, I have to say, in the last year, too many commercial sweet pink wines. I get sent a lot of those.
Do you?
I think they think that it's suitable for my column.
Yeah. Your girl's book. Yeah.
Exactly. They think, oh, look, she's a girl. She'll like our horrible confected pink
wine. Although, that said, I We're at the wine show at the moment, and the Matthias guys grabbed me and said, you know, when was the last time you tried Matthias Rose? And I said, oh, probably about 20 years ago.
Oh, when I was about 16, fell into their trap.
I did, but to be honest, it, you know, because I, you know.
Not so bad?
Not as bad as you imagine.
Okay.
You know,
good.
And I, you know, it's obviously commercial and all that sort of stuff. Not a great wine, but certainly.
Better than some.
Better than being that it's derided. It's derided pretty hard by a lot of people, but structurally.
Well, you know, I think, don't you think fashion and lack of fashion in wine is a terrible thing? I'm not interested in what's fashionable or what's not. Yeah. I'm interested in what tastes good. So, yeah, fine. If they've made it, I had heard they'd made a slightly drier product, actually. So
they've got Tempranillo.
Maybe,
that's
maybe I'll go and taste it. Maybe. But can I go back to something that really excites me?
Yeah.
I live in Devon. I don't live in London. I'm one of the wine journalists that has escaped London. And I live near Exeter. And one thing over the last year that has been thrilling is Southwest English wines.
Good, aren't they?
We are suddenly doing so well. And I've been to some of the wineries and I've given tutored tastings of English wines, two or three in the last couple of months. And it's terrific. Suddenly we're doing great sparklers, great white wines, lovely kind of meadow flower aromas.
Yep.
And I'm not so keen on the reds, but, you know, the odd good red popping up. But the era of English winemaking has arrived. So
I think a lot of that is maybe due partly to Plumpton, because the English winemakers now know how to make the stuff.
They're properly trained.
Yeah, whereas before they were just like me trying to make a bottle of wine, and I'd dread to think what that would be like.
Well, this is absolutely it. It's not someone's hobby anymore. It's someone's profession, and there's a whole new generation of people making wine very seriously. But, I, you know, do you think it's a threat to New Zealand then? A new cool climate winemaking country?
No, not yet. Not,
not yet.
But they did do an English versus New Zealand comparison about 6 months, a year ago.
Right.
And England did all right, obviously. You know, I'm a big supporter of English wine, so you sort of torn me between my two passions.
Well, look, I mean, I, fair enough. And actually, if you like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you'll probably like the aromatic, dry English
whites. Because
it's exactly.
Yeah.
Bacchus is a great, great variety. I think the problem for them is still price. There are no economies of scale in English winemaking, so you do have to pay a premium. But, you know, they're terrific. And really, the best way to taste them is to go to the wineries and, you know, go and have a snack and do a tasting actually in situ, and that's just delightful. And what, I will always champion the Southwest ones.
What do you reckon? What do you reckon from the Southwest then?
Camel Valley. Camel Valley
and
Bodmin Cornwall is terrific. It's a lovely day out. It's got a gorgeous spot for tasting, gorgeous tasting room with a balcony. You can sit and try Bob Lindo's fantastic sparklers.
Yeah,
they really are.
Is quite nice as well.
Make good still wines too. If you're in Devon, nearer to where I live, Sharpham, and they have a dairy on the premises too, which makes Sharpham Brie. That is just the most blissful way to go and have a wine tasting. But there are some smaller ones too. There's a brand new one called Kenton near Exeter. There are several more that I could recommend. But it's really worth getting in the car and having a day out at an English winery if you're in the country.
Trainspitter.
Oh, actually, yes. Or get someone to drive you.
Yeah, your wife.
Husband.
The other half.
Exactly. Your chauffeur. But yeah, they're exciting.
Excellent. All right. I think we're going to wrap it up there. Keep it quite short and sharp. But thanks very much, Susie, for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Cheers very much. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Susie. Next week, we start a two-part series looking at the Riesling grape. Riesling is one of the top white grapes around and one of the top wine grapes altogether. And we start by talking with John Forrest, one of New Zealand's leading experts and a passionate Riesling fan. And the week after that, we follow up with German's own outspoken winemaker, Ernst Lucen. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.